So I'd like to introduce my friend, Dr. Bilal Joseph. I've had the privilege of knowing Bilal since 2005 when we tried to recruit him to work in Boston. Wisely, he took the job in Tucson, Arizona, not just because the weather is nicer, but because he has thrived there. And now I'm asking him for a job. So it's fantastic.
Nothing but comedy up here today. It's great. Good morning. I think, what you're hearing a lot today is we're still kind of discovering how we're resuscitating our patients. And I don't think we have all the answers in all three talks that you're going to hear for today. And we still have a lot of work to do. But I think we're moving in the right direction, finally. I have nothing to disclose. This whole idea, you're going to see a lot of this, some of the same slides in all of us, because there's not a lot out there and we're still trying to define this. But trauma-induced coagulopathy versus acquired meaning medication-induced, geriatric trauma is on the rise and more patients are coming in with this acquired coagulopathy. But what we're really going to focus on are patients who are trauma-induced coagulopathy. And when you talk about factor replacement, TXA, fibrinogen, factor 7, and PCC, Dr. Schreiber is going to talk about TXA. But I'm going to mention something. You see factor 7 up there, like why is that even up there? Where are we going with all this? But the real question is how are you doing it? Why are you doing it? Does it really work? And that's hopefully what we can talk about today and kind of get to. Again, this is very common data here, but the reality is that trauma injury is still leading cause of death now up to 48. We know exsanguination is right there next to CNS injury. We think we're doing a great job, even with all these centers that are out there, but we're still watching patients die from bleeding. And I think that's what we're all standing here. And why do they continue to exsanguinate? And there's different reasons, but the coagulopathy of trauma is real, and it happens in our patients. We're learning more and more with the TEG and the ROTEM, but it makes your patient sicker and more likely to die. And when the coagulopathy of trauma, again, what we're focusing on is this trauma-induced coagulopathy. Our understanding of this since 2009, when I was a fellow till now, it's almost like a complete different language. And this whole idea of shock and tissue hyperperfusion itself leading to different pathways that eventually lead to coagulopathy. And so how do you interject or stop this from happening is the real question. And this whole idea of damage control resuscitation, damage control surgery, you see a lot of these things out there, but are we really practicing these things? Are we, early control, permissive hypotension, limited crystalloids, and even factor replacement is part of damage control resuscitation. How many people in the audience are using factors in their damage control resuscitation? PCC, fibrinogen, I think less than the people using TEG and ROTEM, so maybe a third. And again, you've seen these studies already. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but this is kind of what has opened our eyes to this. And this whole idea of early administration of blood products like plasma and platelets reduce mortality. And then this whole one-to-one-to-one resuscitation improves hemostasis and fewer death from exsanguination. And then you heard Dr. Sperry talk about whole blood. I mean, we're coming full circle now. When you bleed out, you bleed blood. And when how do you resuscitate? Hopefully with blood. And so then this whole idea of TEG-based resuscitation versus goal-directed hemostatic resuscitation, should you just go to an MTP or should you actually be checking TEGs and ROTEM? We don't know the answer to that. But I think we're heading in a direction where more data may help us. And this whole preemptive one-to-one-to-one versus goal-directed, now whole blood is in this whole circle here. And so, the different factors work at different parts, and whether it be TXA or the fibrinogen or the factor 7 or the PCC, how do we use these factors now for resuscitation? I'll spend a few slides on fibrinogen. Most of us use it as cryo. There's been different studies that say whether or not it works or not, but the fibrinogen helps solidify the platelets into forming the clot. This study by the USC group in 2013, looked at the impact of fibrinogen levels on outcomes of acute injury. And you can see here that having less than 100 of fibrinogen level, your mortality at 24 hours and in-hospital mortality is almost twice that of those that had normal fibrinogen levels. And this is almost 5 years ago. And then there's more. This is the Europeans, I think, are a few moves ahead of us in this. But this is another study looking at 18 male pigs, hemodilution and a blunt liver injury. They randomized them to placebo and then high dose or low dose fibrinogen levels, and then looking for endpoint of hemostasis. And here again, what they found that the ones that had fibrinogen, there was improved coagulation profile and decreased blood loss, and you know, higher dose was not better though. So giving more of that was not necessarily better, but there was some improvement of those who got fibrinogen versus those that didn't. And I think that's the important message there. And then here's another study, again, many years ago, 5-year analysis of the German trauma registry, looking at patients with fibrinogen levels versus no fibrinogen, a propensity matched, and looking at VTE and time to death and mortality. And, you know, again, the group that had better fibrinogen had prolonged time to death or improved survival, decreased 6-hour mortality due to exsanguination or coagulopathy, and then no effect on the VTE rate. And, you know, but there was a higher rate of this multi-organ failure in this group. And so you start, you know, this was almost, again, 6 years ago. Our resuscitation strategies have definitely changed in these years. But here's in 2017, this is a single randomized controlled trial, adult trauma patients with Rotem, and they basically did coagulation factors, which majority of the patients got fibrinogen versus FFP alone, and it was only 50 patients in each cohort, but they looked for need for rescue therapy, massive transfusion, multi-organ failure in these groups. And what they had was the coagulation factor group actually had lower rate of multi-system organ failure. It decreased the need for massive transfusion and decreased the requirements of what they defined as rescue therapy. And here now are two more trials looking at basically just fibrinogen use. Is it, you know, could they give fibrinogen safely and with the appropriate dose to patients? These were within the last year. And really what they found is, you know, the lower level of fibrinogen, there's no increase, improves coagulation profile, it decreased the overall blood loss. There's still this question of multi-system organ failure, but we definitely need more data, but we're heading in that direction. And I think fibrinogen. So I think, you know, fibrinogen in patients with low fibrinogen levels on presentation definitely is probably something we would recommend. I'm going to talk a few slides on factor 7. Factor 7 made a huge push in the early 2003 to 2008. There's a lot of studies and kind of faded away. But more recently, people have been looking at factor 7, mostly for TBI. We know there's a high mortality with TBI patients. And it's really about the activity of factor 7 and the impact on progression or of coagulopathy and the hemorrhage itself. You know, and having a lower factor 7 functionality, there's a higher risk of coagulopathy, higher risk of progression. So there's some association, but factor 7 levels were lower in patients who died, but not statistically significant in this study. And this was a 2-year prospective analysis, 87 TBI patients, non-randomly allocated to either factor 7 or blood products, looking at VTE, reversal coagulopathy, and again, progression of intracranial hemorrhage. And here again, you know, factor 7 administration had a lower risk of progression of the bleed, higher rates of correction of INR, and an overall lower mortality. But again, not significant. This was recently published in 2018 in TASCO, the new online journal, 2-year retrospective analysis, 150 patients, TBI, factor 7 and 49 versus no factor 7, looking at mortality and improvement in GCS at discharge, see if there's a clinical impact by all this. And, you know, basically they had a lower improvement in GCS in the group that actually got factor 7, no improvement in mortality, and no impact on complications. I don't know where factor 7 lives, to be honest with you, and I really think that this is not a factor that we're using currently or should be using. PCC is the other one. Again, there's different forms. PCC is a 3-factor or 4-factor. Maybe 2 years ago, the FDA approved the 4-factor PCC in the United States. Again, the 3 factors are different. We use Profil 9 SD until we our institution moved on to K-Centra, which is a 4-factor. And it just, the 3-factor, 4-factor, the difference between the two is just the amount of factor 7 inside the PCC. If you have a higher amount, it's considered 4-factor, lower amount. But they both actually have 4 factors. You know, so PCC has been around for a long time, mostly for the treatment of hemophilia. It's been around. We use it as first-line therapy. It's progressively shifted from hemophilia to vitamin K antagonists. It should be your first-line therapy for reversal of vitamin K antagonists like Coumadin and whatnot. Recently, there's an increasing interest in trauma-induced coagulopathy. And although it says interesting, a lot of the animal studies done on this topic were done in Germany early in 2009, 2010, and we'll talk about some of those studies. The real approved indication is reversal of major bleeding caused by vitamin K antagonists. There's off-label use is more on the life-threatening bleeding associated with basically coagulopathy of trauma or trauma-induced coagulopathy. When you look at PCC, there's been different comparison groups over the years, and I think it's important to note this. One is, you know, PCC versus other factors. There's PCC versus FFP, so as separate entities, and then there's PCC in conjunction with FFP. And we'll go through all three of those to kind of get to a point where we are today, and I think that the third one is the right answer. It's not an individual factor to choose alone. You actually use it in conjunction with the rest of your resuscitation. And, you know, here's an early study, 2010, 21 pigs, randomized hemodilution coagulopathy. They either got factor 7 PCC or isotonic saline, and they had a spleen injury, and then they looked at time to hemostasis. And this, again, was done in early years in the Germany lab there. And what you see is the PCC is the dark line here, and the time to achieve hemostasis was faster in the PCC group. And remember, this is only PCC. They weren't giving anything else versus the factor 7 group. And this is when we first started thinking about using PCC in trauma for coagulopathy. And then they looked at other things like, you know, thrombogenesis, and again, looking at thrombin peak times. And again, the PCC group was better than the 7 group. And there's different reasons for that. We actually looked at this in our TBI patients early on. This is 2013, 85 patients. Some got PCC, some got factor 7. And this was kind of when PCC was, or I mean, 7 was going away. And we were just introducing 3-factor PCC into our cohorts. And we looked at transfusion requirement, hospital costs, and mortality. And you can see here, you know, PCC versus 7 alone in human data, again, retrospectively, it decreased the overall requirement of transfusions, both FFP and blood. And then there's this whole cost. Not the study wasn't powered for mortality, but we did see a little difference there. And then this whole idea went from, okay, with 7's gone, let's take PCC versus FFP as two entities. And it really, when you resuscitate patients, you're always giving them some volume expander. And we know plasma's what I call miracle fluid, and I think that's what's changing everything. And so PCC, you know, can be used more rapidly, FFP, no thawing, no blood group, even getting thawed FFP is not an easy thing to have. It's, and you hear Pittsburgh talking about doing it pre-hospital. And PCC is more, you know, but we know PCC is more effective than FFP in reducing the INR, even to a lower level. And so here was a study done early on, same group that looked at PCC versus FFP. 47 male pigs, hemodilution, they randomized them to either saline, PCC, low-dose FFP, or high-dose FFP, and they looked at, you know, lab assays and different outcomes. And again, here, the PCC group was just as good as, did not have a prolonged PT time as compared to the 7 and some of the, I mean to the FFP group, either low dose or high dose FFP. And so this is when we started thinking, well, you know, maybe there's some advantage here. So again, PCC versus FFP in dilutional coagulopathy, the time to achieve hemostasis, you can see here again, the time that took PCC was actually better in the bone model or the spleen model for what they define as by based on laboratory values as reversal of the coagulopathy. This was a study we did then looking at PCC versus FFP, 81 patients who we used INR greater than 1.5 with lower extremity fractures, 27 got PCC, 54, and again, we were just kind of moving forward with this. Time to INR correction, transfusion requirements, time to surgical intervention, non-anticoagulated patients, non-Coumadin group, it's very clear. And we looked at overall VTE, and again, we overall saw with our PCC group, there was decreased time to INR correction, decreased time to surgical intervention. You start talking to the orthopedic and neurosurgeons about these factors. These are things that we know can make a difference in outcomes. And decreased requirement of overall transfusions, 5 versus 7 units, 3 versus 5, but no effect again on VTE. And so then this whole idea of PCC versus FP, not everyone thought this was a good idea. And then this whole thing of consumptive coagulopathy that actually is caused. The military had a lot of interest in PCC, if you can imagine. If you could carry a small vial of PCC with you, you could give it to someone injured in the field, but without resuscitation. This study here again looked at PCC versus FFP, 27 male pigs randomized, isotonic saline versus low dose or high dose PCC, looking again versus FFP, looking again at, you know, the same outcomes. And what they found was, you know, improved survival and decreases blood loss, as we discussed. But they had 100% of their animals develop VTE and 40% develop DIC when you used PCC alone. And PCC may cause this DIC and consumptive coagulopathy. Matt Martin's group at Madigan, the Army Center, spent a lot of time and they did a lot of work on this, looking at 20, they kind of went toward the animal route. Again, they randomized pigs to 4-factor, 3-factor, or 4-factor plus FFP, looking at how these made a difference. And I think, you know, again, what they found was when they used PCC alone without resuscitation, resuscitation. They failed to correct coagulopathy. There was transient improvement in the coagulation profile, and they found depleted levels of platelet and fibrinogen and in the three-factor, more than the four-factor group, but not in the group where they used PCC and FFP. And so this whole idea of maybe it's not one versus the other, but they could work together, and you know, PCC as an adjunct to FFP, and this is what we started terming also when we started doing this clinically. It wasn't one or the other. We had very rare clinical patients that we ever gave PCC without some sort of resuscitation to. And so this was another study done by the Madigan group, Martin's group, and they looked at 60 swine, hemorrhage and ischemia reperfusion. They had seven groups, a control group, and then they had FFP alone, TXA alone, PCC, and then PCC in conjunction with these, and we're going to just focus on the PCC or TXA. What they found was when you co-administered it with the FFP, they improved the blood pressure, decreased the lactic acidosis, they corrected the coagulopathy, and they had improved clot formation and strength. This is around the same time we started looking at, well, you know, let's look at our data, the three-factor PCC plus FFP versus FFP alone. And most of the time we were giving this in massive transfusion patients, we would give PCC in conjunction with the MTP. And again, it was, we looked at time to correction of INR, VTE rates, transfusion requirements, and hospital costs. And when we looked at it in conjunction versus FFP alone, again, we saw a rapider correction of the INR, decreased requirement of transfusions, and then again, similar costs, and again, a lower mortality, but I don't think you can argue that for this study, for the power of this study. And then we said, well, let's keep going. And we did a study that we published, again, looking at INR greater than 1.5 and not on anticoagulants, propensity scored four-factor PCC, because now we had done three-factor work. We're like, was four-factor any better or any different? And we did four-factor PCC plus FFP versus FFP alone, looking again at the same endpoints. This is just published 2018. And again, whether in the four-factor data, you know, we proved it in the three-factor, but in the four-factor data, we see the same outcomes and the same improvements of correction of INR time, decreased requirements, and again, no difference in the VTE, and we see this lower mortality rate. Then we said, well, let's look at our, you know, three-factor versus four-factor. You know, is four better than three? Again, five-year analysis of all of our patients, four-factor versus three-factor plus FFP, looking at the same endpoints, correction of INR, transfusion requirements, mortality. And what we found, again, that the four-factor, actually, there was an increased reduction in correction of INR over the three-factor. There was decreased requirements in the four-factor group compared to the three-factor group, and no difference in VTE and no difference in mortality between the two, whether you use three-factor or four-factor PCC. This was recently presented at the AAST, two-year analysis of the TQIP data. It was kept being a single institution. We were like, let's look and see what's going on in the national trend. Again, patients not on any anticoagulations, coagulopathy trauma, propensity score matched 1-to-1, four-factor PCC plus FFP versus FFP alone, looking at transfusion requirements, complications, and mortality. And again, four-factor PCC plus FFP versus FFP alone, we saw a decreased requirement of transfusions overall. TQIP only gives you 4-hour and 24-hour transfusions, but we had improvement at those two time points, lower rates of acute kidney injury ARDS, no increase in VTE, and overall lower mortality in this cohort. And so there are different guidelines on how to use PCC. Again, I think the Europeans are a little bit more aggressive, and moving forward, we're still trying to define the data. And really, PCC is an important adjunct for resuscitation. I think it improves survival without increasing the VTE risks. I don't think the VTE risks are there. And four-factor may be better than three-factor. I think in patients with deranged INR and coagulopathy of trauma or where you're using MTP, early use of factor may help reduce the overall blood transfusion volume you need and may improve our overall outcomes. Just two slides on acquired coagulopathy and some of the factors. You know, we've all seen the direct thrombin inhibitors, the 10As, and how they've impacted us. There's a lot of reversal agents out there now, but just know that PCC was for first-line therapy for warfarin. For the 10A inhibitors prior to the reversal agent, you know, PCC was the standard therapy. And then for DTIs, if you don't have some of these drugs that cost about $80,000 to $120,000 per dose in your institution, you know, PCC is a valid option. So I think in hyperfibrinolytic patients early on, you know, TXA, we're still out there. I think the there's this big war between England and America, whether or not we should be using TXA. They say yes, we say maybe. I think second, consider fibrinogen deficiency. I think we need to do more work and define when we should be giving this, but I think fibrinogen concentrate will be a part of our resuscitation. And then third is the factors. I think if you're going down to MTP, or have someone with severe coagulopathy, I think PCC can definitely help. There's a lot of new studies coming out. We're actually looking at a randomized trial in Arizona with a few centers looking at PCC plus FFP. We're trying to figure out where to start it, whether it be MTP pre-hospital. We're still designing. Other people are looking at the same thing. So thank you so much. And I'm happy to share my slides if you want to email or tweet me.
Questions for Dr. Joseph? Dr. Yowler.
Yeah, so adding PCC obviously drives up your costs. What would be your recommendation of when do you pull the PCC trigger? As soon as the MTP is initiated, after you get a TEG or a Rotem? I mean, if we just use it for every, as you know, if we use it for every transfusion, I mean, it's going to wipe out our, you know, our budget.
But I mean, the cost is about $1,500 per patient, which is about 3 units of FFP maybe. I don't know, maybe less. I think if you trigger MTP and you obviously have a bleeding patient in front of you, that's one. I think in the operating room sometimes you may go through your massive transfusion and you're in the operating room and you're still seeing that coagulopathy that you can't explain based on a TEG or a Rotem or anything, but just your eyes and the way you know is operating, that would be another area. We see it, we give it, and it's just phenomenal. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to stand here and tell you there's prospective randomized controlled trials yet, but there, I think that the factor replacement is real and we're still getting there. And that's why I think whole blood is so sexy, because it has a lot of this stuff that we need. And this is another way. What if you give, you know, what if you're at a 3-hour away transfer, 2-hour transfer, and you can give, you know, crystalloid and PCC? I don't know. Would that make a difference? I know Dr. Schreiber is doing a lot of this work as well, and he knows some of the questions he's going to work on. And I think once you're in the hospital now, so I don't think cost, and what's the cost of a human life? I mean, we spend a lot of money on a lot of things, so.
So Bilal, you know, plasma is balanced with respect to coagulation. It's actually would correct a hypercoagulable state or hypocoagulable state. Obviously, we don't clot as we walk the earth. Or at least most of us don't clot as we walk the earth. PCC is a fraction of that, and really, there's about 200 proteins in it. Where does it sit with respect to hyper versus hypocoagulable compared to plasma, which is balanced?
I think that when you look at all the studies done for correction of the acquired coagulopathies, I mean, it doesn't overshoot very often. It's half, you know, its half-life is about 24 hours. It works within 20 minutes. I think that there's a lot of pluses and minuses with plasma. I believe plasma, like I said, is the savior juice that we need. But I don't know, Dr. Schreiber, the exact answer to your question, but I think its safety profile is pretty good. And when we use it in the acquired group, in the coagulopathy trauma group, I think we're learning and we're not seeing, and none of this, we've had over, I think, 500 patients. We haven't seen an increased risk of VTE or cardio, you know, or stroke or MI in this subsort. So,
thank you.
Thank you.